Okay, thanks for coming out. As you know, the discussion section that's normally scheduled for tonight will take place during the lecture time on Friday when I'm away, which will be not tomorrow, but a week from, which is closer to the exam and should be helpful to you. Okay, so we're really, this lecture and the next one could be the most important ones in understanding where we're actually going and being able to do something with the quantum mechanics we've been using. So we saw last time that what makes things reactive is having, everything has a highest HOMO, highest occupied molecular orbital, and a lowest unoccupied molecular orbital. But when these are unusual is when you get reactivity, an unusually high HOMO or an unusually low LUMO. So what makes these things weird? We started this last time. If you have a valence shell atomic orbital that isn't mixed with anything else, so it hasn't gone either down or up, then that's one that can be unusual. Having poor overlap, that is, that an isolated atomic orbital has no overlap with anything else, right? If there can be poor overlap, not none, but not so good, so that can make things reactive. Or you can have atomic orbitals that aren't routine atomic orbitals, aren't based on carbon or hydrogen. So that can change away from what's usual in terms of carbon-hydrogen or carbon-carbon bonds or antibonds. And you can have electrical charge, which obviously has influence on the energy of electrons round and about. So last time we looked first at unmixed valence shell atomic orbitals. So you can have a proton which has a vacant orbital, same energy as this. It's got a positive charge, right? So electrical charge plays a role. So that's an unusually good place to put a pair of electrons. So it's an unusually low LUMO. So is BH3 an unusually low LUMO? Even though boron doesn't have a very high nuclear charge, so you wouldn't think it would give rise to low energy orbitals, it's still unusually low on the basis of what we're just talking about. It hasn't mixed with other things to go way up the way most vacant orbitals have done. So that's unusually low. By the same token, this one is unusually high on nitrogen. Not quite as high on oxygen with its bigger nuclear charge, but you can raise it higher by putting a negative charge. And if you have both negative charge and not a big nuclear charge, so carbon anion or hydrogen anion, then you have an unusually high molecular orbital. So these species are unusually reactive species. H plus, OH minus, it doesn't surprise you. NH3, Lewis told us that unshared pairs made that reactive, and so on. And then we looked at not no overlap at all, which is what's the case there, but at ones with poor overlap, where you have side-by-side overlap of p orbitals rather than things that point toward one another. So this one doesn't go down very far. That one doesn't go up as far as normal. So this is unusually low LUMO. It's an unusually high HOMO. If you had to say which is more impressive of these two, you'd say it's the high HOMO because it started a little higher with p orbitals on carbon rather than sp3. But in fact, both of these make carbon-carbon double bonds reactive. In the case of a carbon-oxygen double bond, you have, again, poor overlap, so not so high, not so low. Now, this one's lower than this because this atomic orbital that we started with is unusually low. Right? So that lowered this, so this is no longer so remarkable. But now that one is unusually low for a vacant orbital, so that one's remarkable. So this has already introduced the third idea that you can have unusual atomic orbital energies. So the carbonyl group is reactive for both reasons. You have a low LUMO because you have an unusually low atomic orbital participating in it, and you don't have very much overlap, so it doesn't go up very much. Okay, and that, as you'll see at the end of the lecture, is one of the very favorite reactive groups in organic chemistry is the CO double bond. Okay, in a simpler case, you can have perfectly good overlap between a halogen and an sp3 carbon, but the carbon-halogen bond has an unusually low LUMO because this one started so low. So that's going to make an alkyl halide reactive. Notice, incidentally, that these energies are qualitative only. I don't pretend to make this exactly where it should be, just to point out that it's going to be unusually low and that that's what will make it reactive. Yeah?
Why is the P orbital bonding?
Oh, it's very difficult to know. In the case of carbon, it's easy to know the hybridization because if you measure the geometry, you measure the hybridization. And we talked about the bond angle being determined by the hybridization. It's much tougher to know in the case of something that's making only one bond and you don't have any angles to measure what it is. And it's some mixture of S and P. It's probably richer in P than in S. But that's not a big deal, and it doesn't affect things we talk about very much either. You know, that's an interesting sort of semi-philosophical thing about science. Things that make a difference, you can find out about, because the difference keys you into what is going on. But things that don't make much of a difference, it's very hard to find out about. Just, that's often the case. Okay, so here in this case we have an unusually low LUMO, sigma star. Okay? Or you can have an atom that's unusually high compared to hydrogen or carbon, like zinc. So a carbon-zinc bond is reactive in exactly the opposite way. What's unusual here is not a low LUMO, but a high HOMO. Right? The LUMO is not so remarkable. Okay. Now, you could try a different metal like magnesium, which is higher than zinc in its atomic energy. So it'll have a still higher. In fact, if this one's high, this one's really high, right? So it'll be even more reactive. The alkyl magnesium compound, carbon magnesium bond, will be more reactive than the alkyl zinc bond because it has a higher HOMO. On the other hand, you could have boron, which is not so very high, being right next to carbon, and that will then have one that's just sort of high-ish compared to what we normally compare with, which is CH or CC. So you can have high-ish or high, right? So in fact, you can tune the energy of this HOMO by controlling the nuclear charge. And of course, it's not just nuclear charge. That's what the periodic table is all about. You go across increasing the charge and making the orbitals lower and lower in energy. But then suddenly you fill the shell and you come back. You go to the next principal quantum number, n, and then you're back more or less where you started and march across again. So fundamentally, it's the atomic number, but you have to bear in mind which row you're in. Okay, and the hybridization changes it, that a sp3 hybrid is a little lower than a p, for example. Okay, but anyhow, in that way, it's possible to tune the energy of the HOMO you want. Now, almost 100 years ago, 98 years ago, the Nobel Prize went to Victor Grignard in France for developing carbon-magnesium reagents that were reactive because they had the carbon-magnesium bond, which is this one here, very high, very reactive, and therefore broadly useful, right? Now, if you have that, if you've given Victor Grignard his Nobel Prize, shouldn't that be the end of the game? Why would you want anything less reactive if you've already got something that's very reactive? Can you think of any reason you might want something that's not so reactive? What might be a reason? Yeah?
You want to preserve something?
Ah, if there are two things you can react with, right? You might be able to tune it so that it'll react with one of them and not with the other one. And this, of course, becomes fabulously important if you're trying to synthesize some really complex molecule that has all sorts of functional groups in it, and you want it to react, be selective in what it reacts on. Then you don't want to take an axe to go after it. You want to take a pair of tweezers or something like that. So there can be an important role for things that are less reactive than what Grignard got his prize for almost 100 years ago. So here's the Nobel website and what it says about Victor Grignard's Nobel Prize. He got it for the thing called, surprisingly enough, the Grignard reagent, which greatly advanced the progress of organic chemistry because there were so many things you could react it with. But that in itself was a problem, right? It would react with so many things that if you had several things there, it would react indiscriminately with them. Incidentally, he shared the prize in 1912 with Paul Sabatier, who got his for hydrogenating organic compounds in the presence of finely disintegrated metals. So he had fine metal things, and he'd treat molecules with hydrogen that wouldn't normally react with hydrogen, but in the presence of the metal, they would do so, and that was an important thing, this type of hydrogenation. Do you know what you call that? What role does the metal, the disintegrated metal, play in this? It's not part of the product, yeah. It's a catalyst. So this is catalytic hydrogenation. Okay. So in fact, this year's Nobel Prize that was announced yesterday morning, this is what we didn't get to yesterday, was awarded to these three chemists, Richard Heck, Eiichi Nagishi, and Akira Suzuki, for palladium-catalyzed cross-coupling in organic synthesis. So it was both the things that were awarded 100 years ago, right? A catalyst, so you don't need to use very much palladium. It's very expensive, after all. And it's something that's useful in organic synthesis to make new bonds, new carbon-carbon bonds. Okay, now, this, if you go to the Nobel website, you can download this thing, which is a little bit more advanced than you're ready for, but if you're interested, you could look and get more details. But I've extracted here from Beckfall's account this figure, which summarizes what these three guys did. They did these reactions, which form new carbon-carbon bonds. So here a bond is formed between R and this carbon to put the R on there. And of course it hasn't drawn the H's, an H has to come off. And X comes off as well, so H and X come off. And the palladium plays the role of a catalyst in this. And in this one you form again an RR, a bond between two carbons. Again using the palladium catalyst. Now all these three reactions named after these three people. This is a coupling of two things. It's a cross-coupling because they're two different things that are being brought together, right? So there's the Heck reaction, the Nagishi reaction, or Heck coupling, Nagishi coupling, and Suzuki coupling. Okay, now they all use the same class of electrophilic partners. Primarily, they need electrophilic means something that likes electrons. Some places that electrons would like to be. Where would electrons like to be? In a low energy orbital. So an unusually low LUMO is what you need. And what all, so we already talked about something that would have an unusually low LUMO that would be RX. What would X be to make this an unusually low LUMO? What kind of thing? Just a couple slides ago, we talked about a sigma bond that would be have an unusually low LUMO. Remember what it was? Halogen, right? Where the mismatch of the orbitals means that the LUMO is going to be unusually low. So all these guys chose X equals halogen. There are some other things that have been used, but primarily it's halogen. So it's that orbital we talked about, sigma star of carbon halogen, is what is in one of the units that's going to go together. And the other one is called the nucleophilic partner, something that likes nuclei. What likes nuclei? Nuclei have a positive charge, stabilize electrons. So something that has electrons to be stabilized is nucleophilic, something with a high HOMO. The higher their energy, the more they're capable of being stabilized. So you want something with a high HOMO. Now, what do you have up here that could constitute a high HOMO in this molecule? The double bond, remember, poor overlap, therefore a high HOMO. Okay, so the high HOMO on the top is the pi orbital, the overlapping of the two p orbitals here on these two carbons. And that's the Heck reaction, to couple an alkyl halide with an alkene to get this kind of alkene, a more substituted alkene. Now the other guys, you chose this route, and they need to put M on here. What do you think M means? It means a metal. Why a metal? Because those are the things that have higher energies than carbon and hydrogen. So these will give unusually high occupied orbitals, right? The things you need to be nucleophiles. So Nagishi used M equals zinc. So a carbon-zinc bond was the thing that had the high HOMO. Suzuki uses boron, the carbon-boron bond being the high orbital. Now we just looked at these things at magnesium, the one that Grignard used, and at zinc and boron. And what's going to be the difference between carbon-zinc, carbon-boron, as opposed to carbon-magnesium? Do you remember that from a few slides ago? It'll be a lower energy HOMO, unusually high still, but not as high as the magnesium one. Okay, so these are going to be good for selective reactions. Okay, and in fact, somebody else who would have been a strong candidate, you can only award Nobel Prizes to share among three people. You can't have a fourth. But if John Stille had not died in 1989 in an airplane crash, he would have been a strong contender for one of these. It's interesting to wonder who he might have bumped, because he did the same thing using tin as the metal. But again, the same kind of thing. And all of them using this palladium catalyst. So these are much more subtle and selective among many different options than the Grignard reaction would be. Now, they involve, of course, this doesn't appear in the product. It's a catalyst. This and this come together, but they won't come together without the palladium, because each of them reacts separately with the palladium first. And then the two things react with one another while they're adjacent to the palladium. And we'll be talking about how this kind of metal catalysis works in much more detail in lecture 32, but it's too soon to talk about it now. But it was important to mention it because of the timely aspect of these reactions with respect to the Nobel Prize. So therefore, these things are useful in synthesis of complex molecules, because they're less reactive and more selective than the Grignard reagent, which got it 100 years ago. Okay, so this having unusual atomic orbital energies does the trick, and we just talked about boron, zinc, magnesium. But you can do the same kind of thing with hydrogen. For example, we talked about the carbon-boron bond that's important in the Suzuki coupling reaction, but the hydrogen-boron bond can also be important for the same reason. It has a high-ish HOMO, right? Because of the energy mismatch here, that one of the atomic orbitals is unusual in its energy. Okay, so is BH3 an acid or a base? It has an unusually high HOMO, we just said. So what's the answer? Is it an acid or a base? What kind of things have unusually high HOMOs? That's a base. Like, just think hydroxide, right? Unusually high HOMO. H+, an acid, has no electrons at all, so all it has is a LUMO. It has no HOMO. Okay, so an acid is an unusually low LUMO. Base is an unusually high HOMO. So what's BH3? It's a base. Okay? And indeed, this is the orbital that makes it a base, the one that's mostly on hydrogen, a little bit on boron, because hydrogen is a lower energy place than boron is. So the best combination is mostly on hydrogen. But remember that boron also has a vacant orbital when we were talking about XH3. And so that's an orbital that's not being shared. And how about that? That makes it an acid. So can this molecule react with itself? Can this vacant orbital, unusually low, stabilize these electrons, which are unusually high? Can it just wipe out its reactivity that way within itself? The answer is no, but why? Why can't you stabilize the electrons that are in this orbital this molecular orbital, by overlapping with this p orbital. Brandon? Matt, you got an idea? It's orthogonal. There's no overlap. Were you looking at the preview? Derek was looking at the preview. Okay, they're orthogonal. There's no overlap, so they can't. One can't stabilize the other. So it can't stabilize within a molecule, but what? So could you have a bottle of BH3?
With another
BH3, right? The vacant orbital of another BH3 could come up and overlap with it because that wouldn't be orthogonal. So we can take this one and put it down here, and now we'll get stabilization. But notice the interesting bond you get. The electrons here were not just on hydrogen. They were more on hydrogen than on boron, but they were on both. So when this boron stabilizes that pair of electrons by mixing with it, now the electrons are shared among three nuclei. Formerly, we just saw bonds between two atoms, electrons shared between two. But these electrons, the ones that were formerly in here, are now shared three ways. Right? So this is a very special kind of bond. Right? You could draw it that way, with a Y, especially if you're from Yale. Okay? So you can get a Y bond where you have three centers, but only two electrons doing the job. So that in when two BH3s come together, you get this very special kind of bond, right? Now, more than that, you see that will call, the electrons that were here have gone down into here, right? So this, the boron here is partially plus, having given up some electrons. You might say, should we say the hydrogen is plus too? Also, should we say the hydrogen is plus? Would it be as plus as the boron is? Notice this bond, the BH bond was made with one electron from boron and one electron from hydrogen being shared, but not shared evenly. More on hydrogen than on boron. Right? And now those same electrons are being shared partly with this boron. So clearly this boron is acquiring a negative charge, a partial negative charge, but this one a partial positive charge, and probably the hydrogen is sort of washed out in this, right? Because it had more than its share of the pair to begin with, and now it's given up some of it. So this should be partially positive, and this should be partially negative. Now, if we look at, there's a vacant orbital on this boron still that we couldn't use within the molecule. Right? But it's going to be still lower in energy as a LUMO because of that positive charge. And what am I going to say next? Matthew? So this is an unusually, an even lower LUMO than this one was at the beginning. What does it need to react with? What's it going to react with, this orbital? Elisa? Which high HOMO? Right, this BH bond, right? And that's going to be still a higher HOMO because it's got negative charge near it. So if this first Y bond would form, obviously a second Y bond can form. Isn't that cool? So now if we just rotate that thing and look at it like that, that's what the molecule actually looks like. It's sort of like, you know, a carbon-carbon double bond with four hydrogens on it with normal sigma bonds, but then a hydrogen above and a hydrogen below the plane, right? So that's the true structure of B2H6. It's got these two bridging hydrogens, these two Y bonds, three-center, two-electron bonds. And that answers a puzzle we had already from Lecture 2 when we were drawing Lewis structures. We said that, you know, that NH3 could react with BH3 by sharing the electrons of nitrogen. But BH3 also dimerizes, we said. How can that do it when it doesn't have those electrons? Right? It has the electrons of the BH bonds that it can use in this way. Okay. So, low energy MOs implies bonding. Is that right? True or false? Aisha? Why do you shake your head?
I think it's false because you need high hormones as well.
Yeah. What actually will do that? That's true. You need something for it to be stabilized with. What actually is true is lowered energy MOs imply bonding. When you start with certain electrons and make them lower by things coming together, that's what makes a bond. Not low, but lowered. If they start low, it's no good, right? You have to have some start in a high HOMO and a low LUMO place to put them to make them go down in energy. Right now, lowered compared to what? Obviously compared to the things that you had to start with. When they come together, if electrons go down in energy, high HOMO mixing with low LUMO, that will constitute a bond and make the energy go down when things come together, require you put energy in to take them apart again. So HOMO-LUMO mixing then is what gives rise to reactivity and resonance. So reactivity is between molecules when two molecules come together and lower their energy. Resonance is within a molecule, right? Now, that's what that actually means is that we had two localized orbital. We looked at the molecule and said there's a bond here, there's an unshared pair here, there's a vacant orbital here, blah, 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 right? So there are these things that could make it reactive. Can it react with itself? Now, we looked at that in the case of BH3, whether that P orbital could stabilize these electrons. If so, then it means we were too naive in the first place in dividing this thing up. We should have taken into account that there's extra stabilization within the molecule that we weren't looking at. So it's not really that there's a reaction within the molecule. It's that we were too naive in our first analysis to see that there was another interaction that we should have taken account of. So that's what resonance is. When you draw a simple picture, but the molecule can do better than that because it sees a way of mixing HOMO and LUMO within the molecule or within our design of the molecule or our analysis of the molecule that we weren't taking account of. And we'll see some more about that later. Now, these orbitals, the high HOMO and the low LUMO, are for obvious reasons sometimes called frontier orbitals. They're the ones that are out in front that are going to react and make an important difference. Okay, so let's look at the shape. There are two things we're interested about in these orbitals. One is their energy. It has to be unusually high, unusually low. The other is the shape of the orbital because you have to get overlap in order to make use of it. So let's look at the shape of the orbitals in HF. Okay, now there are four valence electron pairs, one from hydrogen and one from hydrogen and one electron from hydrogen, seven electrons from fluorine, valence electrons, eight electrons, four pairs, and there are five valence MOs, the 1s of hydrogen, the 2s and the 3 2p's of fluorine. So we're going to put together five valence atomic orbitals, and we're going to generate five molecular orbitals, and four of those will be occupied by electron pairs, and one will be an unoccupied orbital, obviously the lowest. Okay, let's look at them. There's the very lowest orbital. That's, as you can see, sort of a 2s orbital. And it's mostly, it doesn't surprise you, mostly it's on fluorine. It looks almost spherical, right? But it's got a little protrusion on the side because there's a little bit of the 1s orbital of hydrogen in it. But 2s of fluorine is much lower, so there's not much of the hydrogen in there. The next one is going to be what? What's that orbital? Mostly. Can people... Somebody guess? Lauren, you got a guess? It looks like a P orbital on fluorine, but it's a little bit unsymmetrical. There's just a little bit of a bulge there, right? So it's mostly the 2P of fluorine, but a little bit of H in it, okay? And can anybody guess what's going to come next? What are we now? Yeah, okay. Christina? Nope. this is what you're going to require facility with. And by a week from Monday, you're really going to have it for the test, okay? So you need practice, okay? The next one is, in fact, two of them. What does that look like? Two that have the same energy. What's that one? What does it look like? It's the p orbital of fluorine. How much of the hydrogen is mixed with it? The 1s of hydrogen. Ellen? Very little or none? Why would it be none? It's orthogonal. There's no overlap between the spherical s orbital here and this one that's plus on the top and minus on the bottom. And the same for the p orbital that goes in and out of the page. So those two are just p orbitals of fluorine. And those are the HOMO, right? They're going to be four valence pairs, 1, 2, 3, 4. So that's the HOMO, is a p orbital of fluorine. And now, what's the LUMO going to be? The LUMO is going to look like this. And it's made of the leftovers. Remember, this was made from a 2s orbital of fluorine and a little bit of this H. This was made from most of the 2p of this 2p orbital of fluorine and a little bit of the H. And what you have left over after doing that is a lot of the H and a little bit of S and P on the fluorine. So you have some sp hybrid on the fluorine, whatever is left over after making these, and mostly the H now comes in. So that's 1s of H with a little bit of the 2spn, whatever n is, of the fluorine. And it's sigma star. There's your antibonding orbital, Christina. Right? Okay. So that's the leftovers. And here's another picture of it. This is taken from a book that was published in 1973 when it was a real accomplishment to be able to draw pictures like this. Now any idiot like me can do this. I just sit down and press a button and I get a picture like this. It was hard to do it in those days. And it's contoured at a different level of the onion, so it looks a little bit different. But in general, it looks the same. It's got a certain sign here, the opposite sign here, and the opposite sign again here. Right? So it's got two nodes, right? It's got a node there, and that's an antibonding node. It's important for us to discriminate between antibonding nodes, those which, when two things came together, made it antibonding. It would be better to be apart. And this second node there, which is also a node, but doesn't have anything to do with the bonding, because that one just has to do with what hybrid of the atom you're using. Right? It doesn't have anything to do with the two atoms interacting. It's just that you're using some kind of sp hybrid on the fluorine. So that one is not relevant to bonding. But this one is relevant to bonding. Okay. Now, let's get more complicated. We looked at HF. Let's look at CH3 with F instead of H with F. And you'll see that much the same thing is happening. Here... Now you have seven valence pairs instead of just four, because the carbon is bringing in a couple more pairs. And there are two more hydrogens, right? So this one you see is mostly 1s on, or 2s on fluorine. This is a p orbital fluorine, but it also has CH bonds in it and so on. But these two are particularly interesting. These are the HOMOs, right? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 valence pairs. These two are the same. Okay? So let's look at that one and see what it's made up of in terms of the carbon-fluorine bond. Here's a bigger picture and slightly different contour of it. What are the? Can you see what the pieces are that went into making up this, or that went into making this up? So what do you have on the left here? It's a p orbital of fluorine. And what's it mixing with over on the right here? A CH bond, right? And little bits of other CH bonds. Or you could say it's a p orbital of the carbon, right? Bonding with this hydrogen, with this hydrogen, and with this hydrogen. Okay? The same thing is true down here. It's a p orbital of the carbon, bonding with this hydrogen, and this hydrogen. So that's on the right, it's the CH bonds. On the left, it's a p orbital of fluorine. And how are these two molecular orbitals, the HOMO and this one, how are they related to one another? Can you see any relation between those two? How could you convert one into the other? Kate, you have an idea? What happens when you put, we have a P orbital here, Kate, and CH bonds here, and we're going to put them together. What happens when they overlap, when two things come together and overlap? What do you get when two things, when two hydrogens come together and overlap? What do you get in terms of molecular orbitals? Speak up. A bond goes down, and what else? An antibond. Now, what do those, so those are the energies. What about the shape of those two orbitals? When you bring two hydrogens together, you get a bond. What does it look like? The favorable orbital. I can't hear very well. Square? I can't hear what you're saying. Sphere? Well, sort of a sphere. It's a little bit elongated, right? Because the two protons pulled it about. But anyhow, they reinforce in the middle. They've added together. Okay? What's the antibond look like? Not what its energy is. It went up in energy. But what does it look like? What does it have that the one down below doesn't have? Okay? A node, right? It's plus on one side and minus on the other. Now, can you help me out here? What's the relationship between this one and this one? How about in this region here? Bonding or not? The two had the same sign. They reinforced in the middle. How about here? Bonding. How about here? There's a node in the middle. And here? So this, all we did to go from here to here is change the sign of the P orbital. So one was adding the two and the other was subtracting the two. Right? Except that now we're mixing, especially on the right, molecular orbitals, these localized CH things, rather than just the hydrogen atom. Okay? So if we look, we have these nodes, but notice that those are, that's an atomic orbital node. It's characteristic of this P orbital of fluorine, this P orbital of the carbon. That's not involved in the antibonding. That's just part of the atom itself, right? You have exactly the same node up above because of the pieces you're putting together. But what's relevant is that node, right? That one's antibonding. So this is an atomic orbital node, and that's an antibonding node. That's the one that tells you whether it's going to be, how tightly the things are going to stick together. Yeah? But as they rotate, the one on the top would become the one on the bottom, but simultaneously the one on the bottom would become the one on the top, so you can't get away from it. Which one is which is different, but you can't get away from it. And that's what happens when you rotate a double bond too. And we'll talk about that some more later. Okay, now this is made up, as Kate tells us, of a P orbital on fluorine and sigma orbitals of the CH bonds here, here, and here. Okay, that's what makes this up. Now, there's an interesting thing we could see. What are the energies of these orbitals that we're putting together? What's the energy of a P orbital of F versus a CH sigma bond? If you look at just the atoms, obviously fluorine is much lower than C and H. No question. Why? Why is the fluorine lower than C and H? Megan? Why is the atomic orbital of fluorine lower in energy than C or H? What makes an orbital low in energy, an atomic orbital? Ah, right. Okay, so you got a big nuclear charge on fluorine. That's fine. Okay, so fluorine should be much lower than C and H, but we're not talking about C and H. We're talking about C with H, right? They got together and went up and down. So this is a more subtle question. Which is lower in energy, fluorine or sigma CH? Now, there's a hint here in looking at these, as to which of them is lower in energy. Suppose one of them was much lower than the other. Then what would the best combination look like? It would be this one, right? Is that the way it looks? Is one much lower than the other so that when you put them together, one of them is really big and the other is really, really small? No, they're about the same, the two halves. Okay? So we know that they're roughly the same energy. The amount of lowering you get from forming this bond is roughly the amount of energy you get by having the bigger nuclear charge in fluorine. But are they exactly the same? Which one is a little bit, if one is a little bit higher than the other, which one's a little bit higher? Right. This is a little bit bigger here than this, and this is a little bigger here than this. Right? So the good combination has mostly the lower energy thing, and the bad combination has mostly the higher energy thing. So it must be that they're very close to the same, but to the extent that they're different, fluorine is a little higher in energy than the CH bond as drawn here, just a little bit higher than that, but very close. But by looking at this, you can see what the computer thinks about their relative energies. Okay, and notice that these two here are these two turned 90 degrees. So that's actually relevant to what you asked about rotating. But we don't have time to go into the details of that now. Okay. Now, these are the seven occupied orbitals, but there's one more valence shell combination, because you started with eight atomic orbital. You started with four, and three, eight, and three is 11. So I'm not showing them all. I'm surprising myself here, but at least this is the next one. Whether there are others, I have to think about. Can anybody help me with that? 4, 4, 4, 4, 4, 8, 9, 10, 11. There must be 11. So one. So here we have 8. There must be 3 more combinations. But we're most interested, of course, in the LUMO. Okay. So here's that other picture of the LUMO. Now let's try to identify. We see that there are nodes here. One sign, the other sign, the first sign, the second sign. So they're nodes. Which of the nodes are interesting? How about that one? Is that an interesting node, the one that goes through the fluorine atom? No, that's because it's some kind of sp hybrid on the fluorine. Okay, that's an atomic orbital node. How about that one? That's the one that cuts through the bond, right? That's anti-bonding between fluorine and carbon. So that's an anti-bonding node. And how about this one? That's a node of a carbon hybrid orbital that's participating in this thing. Okay, so that's another atomic orbital node. This is the one that does the business that makes it anti-bonding. Okay, now, why is this unusually low in energy, this LUMO, that would make it a reactive group? What makes it unusually low? Is the overlap bad? No, perfectly good overlap. Why is it low? Unusually low, the LUMO. Compared to what? Compared with sigma star CH, our standard vacant orbital. Why is this one low? Because the halogen is unusually low that it's being made from. Right? The fluorine is down here. The fluorine was much lower, which means that this got dropped down lower. So this is an unusually low LUMO, sigma star CF. Okay, now, this is what we looked at before. Sigma star HF, the low LUMO. Okay? And the only difference, it looks very, it's the analog of this, but because of the way the book was published, it's turned around. Here are the fluorines on the left, here are the fluorines on the right. But if we turn it around, you see this antibonding node here would be this, like that antibonding node here. This sp hybrid on the fluorine would be like this sp hybrid on the fluorine. Okay? So really, it's the same thing, whether it's CH3 on attached to fluorine or hydrogen attached to fluorine. It's reactive for the same reason. Now, let's then look at these analogies among lowest unoccupied molecular orbitals that make things reactive. And you'll see there are what people normally think of as different reactions, which are really the same reaction because they're happening with orbitals that are really the same. Okay, so here's HF. Here's that LUMO of HF. And HF is an acid, we know, and it can react with OH minus. So how does OH minus react with HF? What about OH minus makes it reactive? Daisuke? What makes it reactive? OH minus. But well, what is it? But what orbital makes it reactive? The high occupant, the unshared pair on oxygen, which is especially high because of the negative charge. Okay, and what makes HF reactive? Taka? What makes HF reactive? The thing we're talking about. Yeah, it's a low LUMO, low because of the halogen, as we just discussed. Okay, so somehow we're going to have those electrons react with hydrogen, which will put electrons into this orbital. Right, this orbital, which is unoccupied, will now have electrons in it. Okay? But when this electron, when this orbital has electrons in it, what do you call that orbital? Remember the name of that orbital? Who remembers the name for that orbital? Derek? Do we call it a sigma orbital? Chris? It's not pi. Pi is when they overlap side to side, and there's a node like this. What? Chris, you got an idea? Remember what pi means? Pi means that there's a node that goes through the nuclei, but not between the nuclei. Pi is these atomic orbital nodes of p's that are coming together side by side, right? This doesn't have that, right? Well done. I know where I can turn. Okay, so that's sigma star. What does the star mean? Cassie? It means what star? Antibonding. What if you put electrons in it? I can't hear very well. No, why do you call it antibonding, sigma star? What does the name mean, antibonding? What if you put electrons in there?
Weak repulsion.
Lauren?
So weak repulsion?
It'll break the bond. Those electrons will be lower in energy if the thing comes. As long as there are no electrons in there, who cares? But once you have electrons, they'll be lower in energy if the things come apart. So when these electrons go on to H, then, now notice the curved arrows designate electron pair shift. It doesn't mean that the OH moves like that. It doesn't mean that the OH moves at all. It just means that the electrons that were here are now here, between these two, shared. So you start the arrow, the curved arrow, where the electrons are at the beginning, and you end them where those electrons are in the product, between O and H. Okay, so that one. Now, what direction will the OH approach this? From. It could come in this way, 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 from all points of the compass. What difference will there be? Which way do you want to approach? Noah? Why? Yeah, but you could attack that from the top, right? What do you want to maximize when the two things come together? The overlap. So remember, this has negative signs in this region, positive signs all around here, and zeros here. So that the further out here you get, the more overlap you're going to get, the bigger the numbers are at a given distance for the overlap integral. Okay? So that's the direction you want to come from. And then when you do that, because it's sigma star, as we were just discussing, has that node there, anti-bonding node, It has another node here. Do you care about that node?
No.
That's just because it's on a fluorine atom, right? A hybrid orbital on fluorine. This is the one you care about. That's antibonding. So when you put electrons in there, this is going to break, and you denote that by the electrons in the bond going on to fluorine. And the product then is F minus and water, which you knew already. But now you see which orbitals mixed and how they caused that. Okay, so that you call an acid-base reaction. Not only H plus is an acid, HF is an acid because it has an unusually low LUMO. And when you go into it, you make a new bond, but at the same time you break a bond. So you mix the HOMO with the LUMO, it can break a bond as well as making it. So where the LUMO has an antibonding node, you break. So you make and break at the same time. Okay, now let's look at methyl fluoride. So there it is. Looks rather like that one. And now you see we have that same node here. Does that make a difference, this node? No. You have a node here, but that's a node of this mostly p orbital on carbon. That's not an antibonding node either. Right? This is where you'll attack from to get the best overlap. Right? Where OH minus will attack from. But you put electrons into that sigma star, and there's the antibond, so that's what breaks. Right? So it goes on to the F, just as it did over here. Same antibond. So it's the same reaction. You get F minus and OH attached to CH3. But you don't call it an acid-base reaction. You call it SN2 substitution. Have any of you heard that name before? I suspect that a few of you have. But it's really just exactly the same reaction as the acid-base reaction. Make and break by mixing this HOMO and LUMO when there's an antibond in the LUMO. So it's the same reaction. Okay, so you could have called this, instead of an acid-base reaction, you could have called this SN2 substitution. See, it's called substitution because the CH3 has an F, and you substitute OH for that, and the F goes away. So you've substituted OH for F on the CH3. You could say the same thing here. You substitute OH for F on hydrogen. You could have said this is SN2 substitution at hydrogen if you'd wanted to, because they're the same reaction. Okay, now suppose we have ethyl fluoride instead of methyl fluoride, which we had up here. Now we have to find the low LUMO of this one. And that's its low LUMO. Now obviously, there are more atoms, it's more complicated. Let's see if we can figure out what pieces went into this and where this LUMO is bonding and where it's antibonding. Because if we put electrons in it, any place that it's bonding will get stronger, and any place that's antibonding will break, get weaker. Okay, so let's see where this is. Okay, so this LUMO is the favorable mixture of two localized sigma star orbitals. Can anybody see what the two sigma star orbitals are that went together to give this? Can you name one of them? Aisha? Right, here's fluorine, looks like that, right? And here's carbon, looks like that. So this part here looks like this. Does everybody see that? Okay, how about the bottom then? What does it look like? What's on the right? Hydrogen. And this is a carbon P orbital. So this is a carbon-hydrogen sigma star bond. So that's sigma star CH, this one. Here's its shape. Here's its energy. There's the one we just talked about, sigma star CF, lower in energy than sigma star CH. But here we've mixed them, right? And have they mixed favorably or unfavorably? When we put the top and the bottom together, did the energy get lower or higher? Linda? Is the interaction of the top with the bottom favorable in this region, favorable or unfavorable? Right, it's favorable. Plus with plus, minus with minus. Right, so we built up electron density in here. So this is this orbital. Right, made up from our two localized orbitals. Okay? Now, if we had SN2 substitution, like the top, then OH minus, let us say, would come in and attack from here. Right? And this fluoride would leave. That's what happened here. What's the problem with doing that in this case? This thing's in the way. If you come in with a blue sign so you overlap with this, you're antibonding with that. That's not good. So what do you do instead? You could come in at an angle like that, trying to stay away from the red part. What else could you do? Luke, you got another idea? If you want to overlap with this orbital, where's the best place to come from? Over here, right? Like that. Okay. So, which of those two will happen? You could imagine it could happen here, and the fluoride would leave, and you'd get a new CF bond, or OC bond, I mean. Or you could imagine it attacking here. Both of those are possibilities, but the only way to know, really, is to do the experiment. And you haven't done these experiments yet, so you can't be expected to know. But you could be expected to know that there are these two possibilities. Okay? And it turns out that this is the one where it happens. Incidentally, that LUMO is not really the LUMO of this molecule. In order to get it so that would be the LUMO, I fiddled around with the calculation. What I did was stretch this bond a little bit and stretch this bond a little bit. And then this was the LUMO. But that's not an unfair thing to do, because when molecules begin to react, they do change their bond distances a little bit on the path of reaction. Okay, now, so what happens? So these bonds were a little bit longer. Now, so OH comes out like this and overlaps with this hydrogen. That'll make a new bond here. But it's also putting electrons in this vacant orbital. Okay? Now, what influence will that have? What influence will it have on this CH bond if we put electrons in that orbital? Oi? Why? How do you know by looking at this that when you put electrons in the orbital, this bond will break, this bond here? What's the characteristic of this that means that? Dennis? Yeah? It's antibonding here. It's an antibonding node. So this will get weak. You may have meant that, Poyi, but you didn't say it. Okay, so this bond is going to break. Now, what effect will it have on this bond between those two carbons if you put electrons in that orbital? What if you look just at this part of the orbital here, the part that involves these two carbons, just at the part in the middle, what would you call that thing? Somebody's talking, but I can't hear. It's not antibonding. It's the node that it's a p orbital here and a p orbital here, bonding between each other. What do you call that kind of bond? It's a pi bond. So you're making a pi bond between these. So the electrons that you lose from here when you break that bond, that antibonding node, right? That's just an atomic orbital node there, and it's actually bonding between the two carbons. So these electrons go and make a double bond there. Now, how about the interaction between the carbon and the fluorine? Wojciech? If you put electrons in this orbital, what influence does it have on the carbon-fluorine interaction? It's an antibonding node. So you put electrons in, the bond breaks. Right? So this reaction with that LUMO pulls off H, fluorine minus flies off, and you get a double bond. And that reaction is called an E2 elimination reaction. And we'll talk more about that early next semester. Right? But you can see that all these reactions are really the same thing. Right? You make a new bond. You make a new bond. You lose a bond. You weaken the bonds wherever there are anti-bonding nodes. And you strengthen the bond where there's bonding in the LUMO that you're putting electrons into. So in this, here you made a bond and broke a bond. Here you make two bonds and break two bonds. Okay, so we have acid-base reaction, SN2 substitution, and E2 elimination, all really the same reaction if you look at it in terms of what the orbitals are and where their nodes are. Now I see I've talked too long. So we'll get on to oxidation of ammonia by chlorine tomorrow morning. Thanks again for accommodating me. Incidentally, I brought along my other laptop that runs this Spartan. If anybody would like to see it, I could stay a little while and show you, but I know you have other things to do as well. Thanks for coming out.